Welcome to episode 10 of 2019 of Refs Roundup. It's great to be back in the studio to chat about the weekend's games and what's happening in the world of refereeing. And a very lovely welcome to my favourite NRL referee and my favourite husband, Gavin Badger. Hello, Gavin.
Hey, Case. How's things?
Pretty good, actually. How about you?
Yeah, not going too bad. Not going too bad.
And how was your weekend? Tell me about your weekend.
Yeah, my weekend seemed like forever ago. I was Thursday night football down in Melbourne. So I had the clash between Melbourne Storm and the West Tigers, which was, you know, quite an exciting game of football. It was, you know, tough and, you know, for most of the game, it was, you know, one score in it. So when you get games like that, you know, every decision matters. So we had to be on our game. And, you know, luckily for us, we were. And I think the players were as well. So we got a really exciting game. And that game, you know, the West Tigers were, you know, probably the better side throughout the game. But Melbourne's professionalism just showed where they just never go away. And I think they scare teams out of victories because they're still there and teams start to worry, you know, they're coming. And it seemed to happen in that game. It was, yeah, a really good game of footy and really enjoyable to be out there amongst that one.
Yeah. And Thursday night football, like you said, that throws a bit of a spanner in the works in terms of what your week looks like. And like you said, it feels like forever ago that you wait for the next round of football to come. How do you find Thursday night football as an official?
It's catch 22 because you get to referee earlier in the week, like it comes around quicker from the last game. So, you know, that part's exciting. And Thursday night football is, you know, it's, you know, high rates on TV and stuff like that. So it's a big occasion for us as referees, just like the players, I assume, that we get out there and we get to lead our teams out for the weekend. So it's an important appointment as a referee. So we all sort of enjoy that one. But yeah, the flip side of that is that I have a long wait till the next game. But the benefit of that is I was lucky enough to have the weekend off, so yeah. It's like a bit of a mini break. I have some training in between and stuff to do, but it gives me the opportunity to go out and enjoy the weekend like normal people do, I suppose, and have too much time on my hand over the weekend. And, you know, for me, normal people is going out and watching footy, so I was out watching some junior footy in the morning. I was out watching you referee, so, yeah, still footy, even though I've got the weekend off.
Yeah, but just watching it in a different context.
Yeah, as a fan, sort of, and, you know, and as a partner and a supporter.
Yeah. What about the stadium down there in Melbourne? I can't remember the last time that I did a Thursday night game down there, but I've always found that it's a great stadium to referee at. The facilities are great. The field's really good. I always find it super loud. They get a standard, 10 to 15,000, sort of depending on the night. Thursday night, sometimes in Melbourne, you know, you can have a bit of a smaller crowd, but usually that 10 to 15,000. But the stadium just seems to hold the noise in. And I know we've had lots of troubles in the past where the crowd goes up and when a big decision's going to be made or a player makes a long break, and amongst our team trying to communicate can be a challenge.
Oh, and there was no different on Thursday night, no different at all. We spoke last week around communication between, you know, our match day coach and stuff at breaks of play and after tries and stuff, and we couldn't even get through that because when we had the ground announcer speaking in between or they placed music in between tries, there was so much echo through our microphones and through our ears that we knew that someone was saying something, but we couldn't work out what it was. So it did make our task a little bit difficult. It's funny because you're out in the field and there's times where you're yelling at each other trying to get, you know, your voice heard because you need a decision made, or around, you know, bunker checks where you want to give your opinion as to the live decision. And on the night, you're yelling and no one can hear you. And then you watch it back on your tape and you think, what is going on there? It sounds ridiculously up.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the whole team has lost the plot. But, you know, and as a match day coach or as a post-game coach, when they watch it, they're thinking, what's going on with this team?
But why is everyone yelling?
When you explain it and say how hard it was to hear, it all makes sense.
Yeah, that context comes into it. Well, speaking of that game and a moment when the crowd went up, was the Ryan Pappenhausen breakaway trials about an 70 or 80 metre break. And I was sitting at home by myself watching it, and I all of a sudden could see your big arms. Your big arm swing happening.
My little arm swinging.
Yeah, little arm swinging big. That's what I meant by it. And I thought, geez, you're trying to make a crack at the gazelle, being the gazelle of the week, aren't you? And were you?
I thought I had it. I really did.
Tell us that story. What happened there?
Chris Butler, who was on the touchline, we've got a bit of a running battle at the moment over who's quicker between Bucky and I. And I reckon I've got him over 100. He reckons there's no chance. I've also got 12 years on him as well, but I still reckon I've got him over 100. So after the game, we have our watches, our polar watches, which give us breakdown of our games, but they're not 100% accurate. So Bucky was quite impressed with his speed on his watch. I think it was 32 k's an hour, and he was sort of gloating about it. And I looked at mine, and mine said 35. And so I started sort of giving him a bit of a hard time. Then we get our correct data from GPS units, which is, you know, quite accurate, and he actually got me by 0.4 of a kilometre or something. So, and he actually says he wasn't even trying. I can tell you, I was trying. You don't often get a chance to really have a crack at that,
yeah.
You know, where you get a break where you don't have to stop. A lot of times when we have long breaks, we've got to stop and look and find where players are coming from. But there was a point with about 50 out where I thought, there's no one coming, no one's getting him. He's not stopping.
I
can have a crack here. Yeah, and I tried to have a crack, and my ego took a bit of a dent when Bucky got me.
Yeah, so, well, that leads me into saying that you were runner-up for Gazelle of the Week, but unfortunately on the GPS data for you, Bucky did have you. So Chris Butler won our Gazelle of the Week this week as a touch judge in that Melbourne and West Tigers game.
If you look at the footage, though, it does look like I'm running faster than him,
and does.
I think I go away from him. So maybe in my mind, I'm going to take into it that there may be some slight malfunction with the GPS units.
Whatever makes you feel better. So Bucky wins that award with a just under 32 kilometres an hour, 31.97, which is
he's fast.
He is pretty quick.
I give him a hard time about certain things, but he can motor.
But within that same game, so yourself as the assist referee, you actually won our urgency award this week. So you cracked the high axel, D-cell speeds 103 times, which is quite impressive. Like we say, any time someone hits over 100, it's pretty solid. Did you think that you were working at that rate by how you felt in the game or after the game?
No, I think the game circumstance added to this. So in this game, I didn't get to referee a set. So we look at it as I spent 100% of the time in the pocket. Normally it sits around that 80-20-ish sort of breakdown of the assist referee's 20% of the game. You know, 20 to 30% of the game, where in this game, just the circumstances of the game and the pressure that we had on, you know, on decisions and 10 metres and stuff sort of allowed for me to stay behind the ruck to do my job there. And so I think by doing that, there's more opportunities to get in and get out, I suppose.
Moving in those movement patterns,
yeah,
which hit those speeds, yeah.
Yeah, which is more susceptible to the assist ref than the head ref.
Yeah, absolutely. And our marathon runner this week was from a different game, from the Dragons and Knights game. It was the assist referee, Liam Kennedy, and he ran 11.1 kilometres in that match, which is, quite a fair distance, but that was the big scoreline in Mudgee. Newcastle got up 45-12. So quite
a few 100-metre jog backs for Liam.
Quite a few run backs.
It'd be interesting to know the last time Liam actually ran 11 kilometres in his life.
He might take offence to that.
Oh, he probably will, but he likes to have a shot when he can, so I'll have one when he can't retort.
Yeah, so quite a high score line. You got to think the referee's standing at the goal kick, and then as the assist referee, you're running all the way back to the dead ball line. So every time that there's a try scored, that you're clocking up that distance. Plus, then with the try being scored, you're pretty much going all the way down the other end of the field in that set of six again. So that can definitely lead to some of those higher distances being run.
It's a fair distance as well.
Yeah,
you know, it's one of the highest, you know, we've probably seen this year.
Yeah, it is. So, last round we had that away game in Mudgee. This round we lead into what is a very special round across the NRL and within our family. It's Indigenous round in the NRL. So I'll just get you, Badge, to talk a little bit about what this round means to you and I guess give the listeners a bit of a background into your story.
Yeah, well, for me it makes me proud to be part of the game. It's a game that, you know, I've been part of since I was 3 years old. It's probably the most constant thing that's ever been in my life, you know what I mean, around, apart from, you know, family, being around rugby league since 3 years old, and then being able to, we talk about one of the, you know, the game's inclusiveness.
Yep, you got it.
around a lot of things, and the Indigenous culture, it's really big in rugby league. Some of the greatest players to ever play the game are, you know, Indigenous men, and it makes you proud that the game then gives back, and then allows the Indigenous leaders, you know, in our communities, who are sometimes often rugby league players, to go back and then give something back to their communities as well, and give those kids something to look forward to, you know, to hopefully one day be able to emulate those guys. And it's not only in the playing space. I know for myself, you know, there are kids that have taken up refereeing young Indigenous kids because they see that I've been able to do it. Mm. You know, it's not always a thing. And in culturally for us, you know, positions of power, you know, aren't sort of looked upon as something that we strive to achieve, whether it be, you know, in officialdom, whether it be police force and, you know, stuff like that. So to be able to go out there and then push that out there myself as well and say, you know, look at me, I'm doing it. Mm. You know, hopefully that gives, you know, young Indigenous kids the opportunity to take up the whistle and be able to enjoy and get the, you know, the rewards that I've gotten over a fairly long career.
Yeah. And I guess the community aspect to rugby league within the Indigenous communities is quite big, and you have had a lot of background within the Indigenous, the Koori Knockout. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and your involvement there, and what the Koori Knockout and in Queensland the Murray Knockout, what that brings to those communities?
Yeah, and it's not yeah, we'll talk about the Koori Knockout, but it's just Indigenous football overall. Like I come from inner city, and you know, probably one of the most famous rugby league clubs in the country, Indigenous rugby league clubs, is the Redfern All Blacks, and you know, growing up around that club, not having played for that club, but playing against and playing in similar clubs. I played with the Zetland Magpies, which was a highly dominant Indigenous club, and then Alexandria Rovers, who, you know, very much the same, you know, both out of highly Indigenous background populations. And just the community and the people that were put back to those clubs, you know, it gave the younger kids someone to look up to. Mm. I never had a father, so I never had someone to look up at. My football coaches and, you know, trainers and managers were the people that I looked up to. They were the ones that gave me the advice. They were the ones that I sort of learnt how to be a man from, or, you know, how to be a human being and how to be respectful and stuff like that. So rugby league and sport in general, but rugby league for me in particular, gave me those opportunities to do that. And I've got no doubt that the person who I am today is born through my involvement with rugby league, and in particular rugby league refereeing, but rugby league as a whole has, you know, has brought me up.
Yeah. So it's great for us to be able to acknowledge that and celebrate it this weekend as a game. And something we're pretty thankful for is that this year the referee's jersey will have an Indigenous theme to it. We've had an Indigenous theme to our jerseys for the last couple of years, but have not had a say in those designs. So similar to Anzac Round this year, where we had a say in the design of it, this year our referee's jersey, yourself and our analyst Christy Mills, have had input into the design of that jersey.
Yeah, very honoured to be able to have some input into it. But firstly, I've really got to give some credit, a massive amount of credit to Jerry Sutton, who, you know, if not for Jerry, I don't think this would have come about. I know there's been some push for a while, but Jerry was the one who really pushed for it and, you know, organised everything. And it's similar to what he did with the Anzac Ground jersey. And this is one of the reasons why Jerry is part of our leadership group. And, you know, I just... all credit to Jerry for organising this, because, you know, it means a lot to me and it means a lot to a lot of other people. So, yeah, thanks, Jerry, for that. Chris Sutton also had a bit of a hand in helping me organise my, you know, the artwork for my totem as well. So, yeah, so as I speak about that, so on this year's jerseys, some of you may have seen on social media that I put some stuff up over the weekend. On the front of the jersey, there's a totem of Christy Mills, who's our data analyst. It's her family totem, and that's the Goanna. Christy Mills' story is very similar to mine in a way, where you know, a lot of her Indigenous culture she didn't sort of know of, because she didn't really know much about her parents and their background. But you know, working a lot of stuff, you know, she finds out that she's, you know, her mum's a Tubbaga woman, you know, from the Wiradjuri Nation, sort of the Dubbo area, and you know, the speaker Dubbo is meant to mean red earth, and you know, her totem is the Goanna. And the totem that you see on our jersey, the Goanna totem, was drawn by her brother. So the little story about Brad, her brother Brad Mills, is a young kid who got in a little bit of trouble and ended up in a boys' home. And whilst in the boys' home, sort of wanted to learn more about his Indigenous culture. He didn't know anything about it because he hadn't grown up in, you know, in an Indigenous environment, you know. So he started to sort of... veer towards the Indigenous art teacher in the boys' home that he was in, and learnt how to draw and how to sort of bring on his side of his culture from within and put it out on paper. And he also learned how to play the didge. So he learned how to play didgeridoo as well. So, so he had the honour of designing the goanna that's on the front of our jersey for Christy and her family. And for mine, I haven't really spoken a lot about my background to a lot of people, but I didn't find out later in life that my father was an Indigenous man. I grew up without a father, never met my father. And it was probably when I was 15, 16, I remember a little bit earlier than that, playing rep footy, and my birth certificate was different than my name on that I went to school with. And then so I started asking around about that, and I had my stepdad's name. And then I found out a little bit more about myself, and then happened to find my grandmother just before she passed, actually, so I didn't get to spend a lot of time with her, but she sort of gave me a little bit of my background. And my family comes from up Kempsey way, so it's Dungati people. And a little bit of research finds that the praying mantis is a totem for my family. So we got that on the back of the jersey, and I'm fortunate enough that Chris Sutton organised for a guy from Coonabarabran. Barabran. Actually, at the minute, I've lost my name. I got a little bit emotional there speaking about it. But if you look for him on social media, he comes under Walkabout Warrior. He does a lot of artwork, and he's from Coonabarabran. Barabran. Sorry that I've sort of forgotten your name at the moment. But he designed the praying mantis that's on the jersey that looks amazing at the moment. And a bit of a background for that, then on the side panels of our jersey, there's a dedication to an amazing... I'm losing my spot
here. Yeah. Amazing woman from Coonabarabran.
Yeah. So it's lost the name as well.
I'll find
Mary Jane Kane. Yeah. Sorry, Mary Jane Kane has we've put a tribute to her on the insides of our jersey. Mary Jane Kane was she organised and put together the Burrabidee
mission.
In Coonabarabran. And she did that it was 1912 when it actually got signed off on. And back then, she was an Indigenous woman who went to Sydney from Coonabarabran to go up to Parliament and put forward her case to have this Aboriginal reserve listed as an official reserve. And in those days, women didn't go to Parliament to organise anything, let alone an Indigenous woman. So for her to organise that and get all that stuff done was amazing. So we've put... The reason why we've sort of looked at Mary Jane Kane is in our pre-season camp, we went to Coonabarabran for the pre-season. And whilst we're there, we went to the Burrabidee Mission and had a look around. It's not a functioning mission anymore. The only part that still functions is the cemetery, which still has people being buried in that cemetery. And it's a sacred place for Indigenous people of that area. And we were fortunate to go there, and we were shown around the Burrabidee Mission by Uncle Casey Dowd, who still has connections to that, who is a descendant of Mary Jane Kane. And he showed us around and gave us stories. And as a squad, it sort of resonated with everyone. And going forward, when this jersey was being designed, and having the fact that, the Sutton boys all come from Coonabarabran as well, so they have a connection to that land, that it was only fitting that we gave that tribute to Mary Jane. And a part of that was when we were in Coonabarabran, we stayed at the youth club. And anyone who knows Coonabarabran, the youth club just sits outside Coonabarabran. And to get across Coonabarabran, you have to cross a bridge across the Castlereagh River. Only less than a generation ago, so early 70s, Indigenous people weren't allowed to cross that bridge. Had to stay outside that bridge and had to be bussed in and stuff to get your groceries and stuff. That bridge is now named the Mary Jane Kane Bridge. And so for us, when we were there, to go to the shop or whatever, we had to cross that bridge every day. Mm. And it just had so much significance to me being around that and seeing that and thinking, when I was born, I was born in 72. When I was born, family, friends, wouldn't
yourself,
have been able
to. You would not have been allowed to cross that bridge.
Yeah. And Casey did say when we were there talking about probably the only thing that did bring the communities together was rugby league, the Coonabarabran Unicorns.
It's the greatest name.
Yeah, the Unicorns did have some Indigenous players in the side. So, sport and rugby league was, the glue that sort of brought those communities together back in the, early parts of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, so plenty of feeling and meaning there behind the referee's jersey. So have a look out this weekend. for those jerseys. You'll see all the referees in every game wearing them. And like Badge said, the Goanna was designed by Brad Mills, and it's Daniel Evans.
Daniel Evans, that's what it is.
The walkabout warrior who did the praying mantis, and Brad did the Goanna, which is an amazing journey jersey.
It's an amazing journey as well.
Yeah. So out of the weekend's games, there were a couple of incidents which raised question. I saw on social media from a few different commentators and a few journalists and fans of the game around quick taps and around when they can or cannot be taken. And sometimes to some fans it seems like an arbitrary sort of rule of when referees allow quick taps off penalties to be taken and when we pull them up. So we thought we'd sort of talk through when we are allowed to have a quick tap and when we're not allowed to have a quick tap. And hopefully it eases some people's frustrations in watching the game.
It frustrates us when we see people frustrated because they don't know the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. So a penalty kick is allowed to be taken quickly on any infringement against the team not in possession. So that means if I'm running with the ball and Badge strips the ball off me, so that's a penalty against him, the team not in possession, I'm allowed to take a quick tap. If I'm running with the ball and I play the ball and it's a roll ball penalty, that means it's against the team in possession. Badger's team can't take a quick tap, okay? Because otherwise, every player would be offside. Everyone's automatically offside. They're not going to be back 10 metres. So quick taps are allowed to be taken as long as it's against the team not in possession, except for these five scenarios, which we'll talk through at the moment. So scenario one is on 10-metre penalties, so an offside penalty. Someone on the 10 metres is offside. And again, the reason for that is that everyone's going to be offside already. We're just going to keep having penalty after penalty after penalty.
Sin bin,
yeah, off a quick tap.
The other one is when a penalty's awarded within the 10-metre zone. So we call it the red zone, so the attacking 10-metre zone. So if I'm attacking Casey's goal line and Casey holds down and I get a penalty, so in any other area of the field, I could take a quick tap there. In this field position, I can't take a quick tap. The reason we have this one is because we can't have a quick tap a metre from the line. The bloke just taps the ball on his foot and puts the ball over the line. That's not what our game is about. It's not the spirit of our game. Our game's about competitive, about, you know, being able to work your way through. That just doesn't look right. And I don't think anyone accepts that to be a rugby league try.
No. So those two are the times that people generally understand and know about by now. So 10 metres.
They're our easy ones as referees.
Yeah, they're easy ones. 10-metre penalties and within 10 metres of the goal line. So you actually, a lot of times, if you listen to the referees' comms comes across on TV, you'll hear the referees say, not quick. So one of our triggers straight away when a penalty is awarded within 10 metres of the goal line, inevitably someone out of the four people on field, the two referees or the two touch judges, someone will straight away say, not quick.
Another thing to go with that one, the one inside the 10 metres, it's where the penalty was awarded.
Yeah.
So I can't get a penalty within 10 metres, run quickly back outside the 10 and say, this is my mark and tap it. Yeah. So it's where the original penalty is awarded.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because a player tried to do that on
the
weekend.
It's happened a few times where they'll run out, which they are allowed to do because they just have to take it back in line with the original mark. And then they're outside the 10 and they go, well, I'm outside now.
Yeah.
We don't allow that either.
Yep. Okay. So the third reason why you can't take scenario where you can't take a quick penalty tap is penalties resulting from kicks in general play. So I kick the ball and I'm tackled late. There'll be a penalty awarded. We can't take that quick because obviously, again, all of our players are going to be out of position.
Yeah.
Again, it's just not what the offside
kick chase.
Yeah, offside kick chase.
And any penalties resulted from
that kick.
Yeah, so another reason is when the referee needs to take further action. So it might be a high tackle penalty or a foul play penalty, and the referee needs to place the incident report. He may need to just speak to that player. You know, he may need to speak to the team. He may need to sin bin. So there are reasons where the referee needs to take further action. It may be just the chat to the captain to say there's been too many penalties, you know, but he needs to do it at that time because otherwise he loses his moment.
The moment's lost, yeah.
Yeah, so that's another factor in it all. And there's variances to that as to why he may need to stop the game. But if for any reason the referee feels the need to stop the game, he'll stop the game and won't allow a quick tap.
Yeah. And the fifth reason is where the mark has been advanced. Yeah. So generally that's going to be back, descent.
Yeah, descent.
Yeah. So, again, it's just going to place all the players, every player is going to be offside. It'll be become a bit farcical. So the other thing we've got to look, so when quick taps happen, there's a lot of, we spoke a few weeks ago about scrums and scrum clocks and that being a real uptime or a lot of things are happening for the officials on field. When penalties are awarded, and especially when a player then does take a quick tap, again, it's another scenario where there are a lot of roles that need to be performed amongst the team. So as soon as a penalty is awarded, if it's within 10 metres of the goal line or it's a 10-metre penalty, someone will say, not quick.
Yeah.
Just to so that if a player does take it quick, their control referee will just call time off and send them back and say, can't be quick. If it's outside of that 10-metre zone and it's not a 10-metre penalty, pretty much the first thing that someone will say will generally be the assist referee telling the defenders to go 10. And you might hear that over the referee's comms.
Yep.
And the purpose of that is that where we don't want those two, so there might be two players who were in the tackle in a reaction, tackle the player who took the quick tap. Because if they do, they're going to end up in the sin bin.
And another part of that is we'll also, you'll see specifically the touch judge will look to make sure that there's none of the attacking players or the team who've received a penalty in front of the kick. One of the big bugbears is, for fans, is that when they do take the tap and there's players in front, why we don't take the ball off them.
Mm.
Do you want to explain a little bit as to why we don't take the, and the reasonings technically why we don't?
Well, the referee has to give the player the mark. So if the referee hasn't given the player the mark and they tap it, they actually haven't.
They haven't infringed.
They haven't done something wrong. It's almost like if at the start of the game I haven't blown the whistle for the game to kick off and a player kicks the ball and it wherever it lands or it doesn't go 10 metres or it goes out on the full, well, it doesn't matter. I actually haven't. The game hasn't started yet. It's almost that same sort of principle.
Similar
we haven't given them the mark.
What we do at a 20-metre restart.
Yeah.
Because same. The fans sort of up in arms when the guy runs up for a quick 20-metre restart, taps it, and we send them back and we go, no, you had a player in front.
Yeah.
And they're going, well, wait up, they're offside from a restart.
But I haven't blown the whistle.
No, we haven't actually blown the whistle, so the restart hasn't occurred. And that's one of our skill sets as referees now, where we work hard to make sure that we don't blow the whistle, blow the whistle prematurely, and we make sure that we wait until everyone's onside, and then we try and hold the players to not go until everything's ready to go.
Yeah. So that one, the 20-metre restart, they're not allowed to take it until the referee blows the whistle. But from a penalty tap,
You just have to verbally
or physically give them the mark. So if that player is on the mark and the rest of their team are all onside, and none of those five reasons we spoke about had occurred, then play on quick tap can happen. The other thing that seems to frustrate people, and I understand it if you don't because you're not hearing what the four officials on field are saying, is when a player taps the ball and you see or hear the referee say, play on, or, because the referee has allowed it, but then all of a sudden they call time off and send them back. Sometimes that happens because the referee can't see, isn't so much in charge of seeing if one of those attacking players is in front of the person who tapped the ball.
Yep.
Because that is a heightened time of awareness for our touch judges that as soon as a penalty is awarded, it's a scan to see is everyone onside or not. If people aren't onside, we try and jump in as quickly as possible and say, offside players, wait. So the referee knows.
And the player with the ball knows as well. We try and stop him from taking the restart.
Yeah. But then there are times where you just physically can't see it. So you've got to.
It all happens too quick sometimes.
Yeah. So you've got to send them back. So it is quite a. It can seem confusing. Like we said, the two most common times when a quick tap can't be taken are 10-metre penalties or within 10 metres of the goal line. Sometimes the 10-metre penalties are against the markers.
Yeah.
And if a marker's not square, they're actually not a marker because they were never square, which means they're just an offside player.
So it's a 10-metre penalty.
So sometimes it looks like it's a marker penalty and you might think, well, why can't we take it quickly? It's because it's actually a 10-metre penalty. Yep. Whereas if the marker was square and left early, then it's a marker penalty.
If he was never there, it's a 10-metre penalty. If he was there and goes early, then it's a marker penalty. When we talk about the skill sets of the NRL officials and, you know, how we work together to make that, you know, as clean and structured as we can, what about the poor bloke out in Mascot Oval on a Sunday afternoon and, you know, without the communications gear, without an assist ref to help him, you know,
possibly without touch judges.
So what's the approach there, and how are we best equipped to handle those situations at park football?
So we teach this stuff to our park football referees. It's within our national methodology in that these are times you can and can't take quick taps. But the overriding principle is you must be in position and ready to officiate the game. So if a player takes a quick tap and as the referee on your own, no comms gear, no touch judges, or I've got touch judges but no comms gear, so they can't really help me there, I'm going to take more time to scan and see if there are any offside players and to weigh up that situation than it's going to take in an NRL game.
Yeah, of course.
So there might be times where a quick tap is allowed because just the way play unfolded, the referee can easily see everyone's onside and I'm already in position and it's all good and they can go. And then 2 minutes later, there's a penalty and they don't let the quick tap go. Because, again, the overriding principle is they must be in position and ready.
So
it also comes down to the skill set of that referee.
That's what I was going to say. So in that scenario, what you say there, lower levels of the game, we're going to be inconsistent by being consistent, if that makes sense. Because the inconsistency is going to be around sometimes we're going to allow the quick tap, sometimes not. The consistency of it is it's only going to be allowed when we're in position. So it's going to be consistently based on when we're in position. And we talk about the skill level. So you might have a 15-year-old kid who's a whippet who can get back into position a lot quicker than a 45-year-old guy who's, you know, running around the park footy because he loves the game. It's going to take him longer to get back. Mm. You know what I mean? So the skill level and the fitness level and the agility level of the officials at those levels is going to dictate how quick the tap's taken. But the one consistent thing around it, and this is the great stuff around the methodology that we have now, is that it will not be taken until the official is in position to take that.
Yep.
So that there's your consistency part around
and,
it.
And the higher you move up in grades and the higher level referee who's refereeing the match, the more often a quick tap generally will be taken because they have that skill set.
Well, you talk about that, and I noticed this year in the Tasha Gale Cup, so which is the New South Wales Rugby League under-18s junior rep girls competition, I noticed that this season there's a couple of sides that any time they got a penalty, they just took a quick tap. Because if it's in the middle of the field, there was times when it was windy and that, and they may not have found touch, so they didn't kick for touch. So what these teams were doing, whether it was one that they could take a quick tap on or not, they just went there straight to quick tap, straight to go. Yeah. So it was a skill set of our referees at that level that they had to know that those teams were going to take them. So they had to work hard to get into position to make sure that they were ready as quick as possible to take those. So, you know, the game will throw up those scenarios to the referees to make sure that they were, you know, were prepared and ready for them.
Yep, on our toes.
Yeah.
So we had a couple of questions from some listeners this week. They were tweeted to us and on Instagram. So remind everyone, if you do have any questions, feel free to tweet at us or flick us a message on Instagram, and we're happy to answer those questions. So I had
no life skills questions.
Rugby league related. Yeah, laws questions only.
I struggle to look after myself.
I had someone, Todd Greasley, who refereed at the same time as I did in 2004 in the Parramatta district. I saw a message from him on Twitter about a bugbear that one of his mates had about releasing the ball to take a tap kick, a penalty kick. So when we came through refereeing,
you used to
actually have to release the ball because when you tap the ball for a penalty or for the free kicks after you kick for touch and you bring the ball in 10 metres, it's actually a penalty kick or a free kick. So you have to kick the ball. If you never release the ball, if I just hold the ball and bring my foot up to the ball, I haven't actually kicked it.
Because the definition of a kick is to impart.
It used to be to impart motion on the ball with the leg or foot below the knee. So you used to either have to put the ball on the ground and release it with both hands and touch it with your foot, or release the ball and you sort of like, you know, kick it up to yourself. So that was a big bugbear for a while. A couple of years ago, that actually got taken out of the rule book. So you no longer have to release the ball to tap it.
There's a famous one. It was a Monday night football game many, many years ago, showing my age now, at the Sydney Football Stadium. And I think the scores were locked and it was 20 all, and it was the Roosters and the Broncos, and the Broncos got our 20-metre restart. Andrew G, I think it was. I may be incorrect there, but I think it was Andrew G who ran up to take the restart and did exactly that, tapped the ball with his foot, didn't release it, and the referee, I can't remember who it was, stood there and blew a penalty 20 metres out in front because he didn't bring the ball into play correctly. They kicked the goal, the Roosters kicked the goal and win the game. So that I think it wasn't long after that the rule changed. I think that may have brought about it because people are like, well, that looks a bit ridiculous. Yeah. And the team loses the game because you haven't released the ball.
Yeah.
So, yeah, technically now you don't have to release the ball to kick it. You just have to touch it with your foot.
Yeah. The other question that we'll just quickly answer is when we take time off at penalties and goal line dropouts and what teams can do with the shot clocks and whatnot there. So I was at Penrith on Friday night and Warriors were awarded a penalty at one stage from nearly straight in front of the posts, and it felt like to the crowd they were booing us to call time off and Penrith were blowing up at us to call time off. And it felt like it took a while for us to do that, and we blew time off not long before the I think it was Patrick Herbert was the goal kicker before he kicked for goal. Both penalty kicks and goal kicks, the players have a minute 20 until time is called off. They have a minute 20 to kick that goal. Like, they can take longer, but you call time off at a minute 20.
And so when does a minute 20 start? Yeah.
So the minute 20 starts from the time the try is awarded, so when you blow the whistle, or from the time that the penalty is awarded, so again, when you blow the whistle. So our match day coach up in the old video refs box, as soon as the penalty is blown or as soon as the try is blown, starts a stopwatch or a countdown watch, either or, it's up to them. When it gets to a minute 20, the match day coach says to the referee, badge, time off. Gavin will then call time off. And then whatever happens after that, the player then, you know, kicks for goal or whatever, and you call time back on. So effectively, if a penalty is awarded with 70 seconds to go on the clock, that team can they can just run that clock down, same as the try. That also applies at the goal line dropout. It's not the minute 20, but if a goal line dropout is awarded and there's 20 seconds left on the game clock,
they can run it down.
They can just run that down. That's the difference to that and the scrum clock, where the scrum clock still takes, like, you still have to be packed within that time, but we can stop the game clock by my team packing into the scrum, and the referee can call time off and stop the game clock, but the scrum clock continues.
Yeah, I'm going to use the word consistency again, and that's why we have these time limits now, because in the past, that's what would happen. Yeah. At different stages of the game, we'd blow time off at different stages. So, and it was broken down and said, well, that goal kick took a minute and 40 and you didn't blow time off. It was in the first half. But then the second half, that kick took, you blew time off at 20 seconds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it didn't weigh up. So now, you know, at the NRL level, we have those clocks. We also have it in the last 5 minutes of play. So, you know, the last 5 minutes of the second half. Anytime there is an attempt for points, so after a try is scored and a shot at goal, or after an attempted field goal or an attempted penalty goal, we blow time off until the ball is brought back into play. And at any stage during the game, after a try has been scored and the conversion is taken, we blow time off until the kickoff.
Yep.
That way, it's just consistent. It's the same. Like, a team might score and there might be a minute and a half to go, and they walk back to the halfway line, and as a referee, you're under pressure as to when you blow time off. Now we're not under that pressure. Yeah. It's just taken away from us. It takes a lot of pressure off the officials.
Yep. All right, so hopefully that clears up a few things for our listeners, clears up or confuses them.
It makes it worse.
So again, if you've got any questions, make sure you tweet us or send us through something on Instagram. So what does the rest of your week look like, Badge, and where are you off to this weekend?
Yeah, the rest of the week's busy training-wise and stuff, but I get to wait till Sunday afternoon, so the last game of
Long
the week this week. So I've gone
game.
From the first game of last week to the last game of this week, Sunday down at Wynn Stadium. I get the local derby between the Sharks and the Dragons. So
nice.
Really excited and looking forward to, you know, hopefully a cracking game of footy. What about yourself? Where you at?
Yeah, that'd be a good one. I'm on the touchline for the Souths and Tigers game at ANZ on Saturday night. So again, looking forward to that. That should be another good, that's usually a pretty good derby sort of one as well.
Yeah, it's always a tough clash, that one.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Both teams are in some reasonable form as well.
Yep, looking forward to it. So as always, I'd like to encourage you to join our Facebook and Instagram pages. So Facebook page is NRL Officiating and the Instagram handle is at NRL Officiating. So give us a follow to keep up to date with what's happening in the world of rugby league officials across the country, from under sixes through to the NRL. And if you're interested in becoming a referee, please visit refrugbyleague.com. Thank you for listening to this week's Refs Roundup.
Bye.